and NPR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, ticks, mosquitoes, and warmer weather. Spring in the Catskills is beautiful, but it comes with risks. Coming up, we talk to Dave Williams from Ellenville Regional Hospital about how to protect yourself from Lyme disease and other illnesses this season. Feeling burned out? We've got just the guy. Brian Fulp from the Himalayan Institute is here to talk about retreats, real-life balance, and why unplugging doesn't mean disconnecting. Plus, the latest episode of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast with Tom Candela, and a wrap-up of yesterday's Songs of Protest concert at the Narrowsburg Union. It's all coming up, but first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Former President Joe Biden has an aggressive form of prostate cancer. His office says it has spread to his bones, but the office also says it appears to be hormone sensitive, and that means there are options for effective disease management. Dr. Ben Davies is a professor of urology at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He explains some of Biden's options.
It could include hormonal injections, which should kind of calm it down and take away some of the testosterone levels in his body so the disease stops growing quite as fast and can kind of almost melt away from the bones. He also can get chemotherapy, which is a great study that happened just a few years ago, which could extend his life if he qualifies for it. And radiation therapy, too, is definitely in play.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Writing online, Biden said that, quote, cancer touches us all. He thanked well-wishers for their love and support. President Trump says that this hour he'll speak by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Trump has been trying to bring an end to Russia's war in Ukraine. Trump also says he'll speak later with Ukraine's president and leaders of NATO. Pope Leo XIV has met with Vice President J.D. Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. NPR's Ruth Sherlock reports the conversation comes ahead of U.S.-led diplomatic efforts to make progress on a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine.
Vance, a Catholic convert, was among the last political leaders to meet with Pope Francis before he passed away. Pope Francis and the Trump administration had starkly different views, particularly on the topic of migration. Pope Leo has already spoken out in support of migrants, and in a readout of the meeting with Vance, the Vatican described, quote, an exchange of views and calls for, quote, respect for humanitarian law and international law in areas of conflict and for a negotiated solution between the parties involved. The Vatican has offered to host peace talks to try to bring an end to the war in Ukraine. Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Rome.
Stocks opened lower this morning after Moody's stripped the federal government of its AAA bond rating. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 40 points in early trading.
Moody's was the last of the big three credit rating agencies to lower its estimate of the U.S. government's credit worthiness. The company warned that U.S. policymakers have failed to address a rising tide of government debt. The move comes as congressional Republicans are weighing an extension of the 2017 tax cut, which is expected to add trillions of dollars in additional red ink over the next decade. That additional borrowing is only partially offset by GOP spending cuts. Stock in Walmart opened lower after President Trump took to social media to say the retail giant should eat the cost of his new tariffs rather than raising prices. Walmart warned last week that some price increases are inevitable given the magnitude of the president's import taxes. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 28 points. This is NPR. The National Transportation Safety Board will hold a press conference today about the crash of a Mexican naval ship into New York's Brooklyn Bridge this weekend. The crash of the tall ship killed two people and injured more than a dozen others. New York City officials say the ship lost power and mechanical functioning. It was pushed by the river's current into the bridge. A barrier is standing in the way of some people's aim to eat well: food prices. NPR's Amy Held reports a new survey finds healthy foods may be increasingly out of reach for some Americans.
While Americans say taste is the top driver behind how they fill their carts, a recent Pew survey finds 70% say higher prices have made it harder to eat healthy.
Some items are definitely getting more expensive.
Peyton Schaefer was grocery shopping in Washington, D.C. and says she looks out for healthy items like tofu and yogurt.
There's days where I'll go and I'm like, ugh. Maybe I should skip those, like, more specialty items.
Inflation is cooling. Egg costs cracking down about a dollar a dozen from the record $6.23 in March, but egg costs remain historically high. Overall, food prices are still up almost 30% from before the pandemic. Amy Held, NPR News.
Pro golfer Scottie Scheffler won the PGA Championship yesterday. It's his third major title. He held off Jon Rahm in the final round to take home the victory by 5 strokes. Scheffler fared much better this year than last year's PGA Championship. That's when the golfer was arrested ahead of the second round for charges that were later dropped, that he wasn't following instructions from police. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As the spring season settles over the Catskills and the upper Delaware, the warmer weather brings more than just blooming flowers. It also signals the return of ticks and mosquitoes. These tiny pests can bring health risks, big ones, especially as Lyme disease and other vector-borne illnesses continue to affect communities across the region. Joining us today is Dave Williams from Ellenville Regional Hospital to talk about what we could expect this time of year, how to stay safe while enjoying the outdoors, and when to seek medical care if you're not feeling well. Dave, good morning.
Hello, Tim. How you doing? Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks for being here. And well, we're well into the spring season, and this is often when those ticks and mosquitoes come out of hibernation. Why is this particular time of year peak season for ticks and mosquitoes?
Oh, well, they're getting ready to feed, you know, so we see a lot of ticks, a lot of mosquito-borne diseases in our emergency department, especially now we're seeing, you know, the ticks that don't get a chance to feed in the fall kind of want to get a feeding in the springtime, and that's how they molt to the next stage, and they spread their, they have their little tick babies, about 3,000 babies per one tick. So you can imagine there's a lot of activity going on right now, especially with the people out there and outdoors and being exposed to ticks. As a matter of fact, probably when you come to our emergency room with a chief complaint of a rash, it's almost always poison ivy or Lyme disease. So that's how common it is right now.
Are there specific weather patterns or environmental conditions that make it worse than in some years than others, like if it's rainier than others?
Yeah, I think if it's rainier, it's probably more beneficial for the mosquitoes. A lot of stagnant water around your property can lead to mosquito habitat as well. But I think that's probably bad for ticks. Ticks do not like it dry either. The high heat that we might see in the summertime kills off a lot of ticks. So I think that's the thing to do around your property is make sure that there's, first of all, for mosquitoes, there's no standing water. You know, you clean up your yard debris as much as possible because ticks and mosquitoes like to kind of live in that moist environment there. But if you mow your lawn really short during the season, that will certainly help with the tick population as well, cut them down quite drastically.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about...
Yeah, children playing on the lawn, right? Children playing on the lawn, they come in, there's ticks on them. You know you got a problem, right?
Right, yeah. Right. Let's talk a little bit more about ticks. It's one of the most concerning things, I think, for most people. One of the most common tick diseases is, of course, Lyme disease, which you mentioned. You're there in the emergency room at Ellenville Regional, so you're seeing all kinds of things firsthand. What should people be watching out for in the early stages of a particular tick-borne illness like Lyme disease?
Yeah, Lyme disease is, don't forget about anaplasmosis, another tick-borne disease caused by the same tick, the black-legged, the deer tick, caused anaplasmosis and Lyme disease. Both have very similar symptoms, and they can present just like a cold, right? Well, not really a cold, but more like a viral illness, like they're achy, feverish, body aches. Fatigue is a big one, really, and they have no rash. A lot of patients, about a third with Lyme disease, will not have any rash. That makes the diagnosis a little more confusing for us, a little more difficult for us. So if you come in our emergency room and you're in the middle of June now, let's say, for example, the entire summer, and you're having these symptoms of like viral illness, you got to be worried about a tick-borne disease, because you can't send them home with just a virus, go home, you're fine. A lot of these people have tick-borne disease, and we treat a lot of them based on their symptoms, and you know, not necessarily that they have any rash, but we're pretty sure that they have a Lyme disease or anaplasmosis, and we treat them with doxycycline accordingly, even though we don't have all the proper tools. But you can't wait. A lot of people, they'll just get sicker.
How quickly do symptoms tend to show up after a tick bite?
Yeah, a tick bite, usually for Lyme disease, I would say about almost always 7 to 10 days. Mm-hmm. Almost always. People come in with it, oh, I pulled a tick off a week later, and they come in the emergency room with a rash. And the characteristic spots where the rash are always behind the knees, one big one. And it looks awfully blue and violaceous and purple. So people mistake it for like a cellulitis, and they give them the wrong antibiotic. We see it all the time still. Armpit, in the belly button, or around the neck area. If you have pets asleep with you at nighttime, you might get it on the chest. But anywhere where it's cold outside or it's cooler in your in the body area, they don't like to be exposed to the sun, right? So like I said, behind the knee. Very rarely on the hands and feet. So that's a key that it's a tick-borne disease and not something else.
You got me thinking. My dog likes to go outside and run around the yard, also likes to come up in bed. So is the same time frame there with animals as it is in humans, like about like 7 to 10 days where something could show up?
Yeah, I believe so. And animals, I went to my vet last week, and they seen a couple of dogs came in. They were all lame and hobbling, and they had Lyme disease. So they present like a lame. They just don't walk right, and they're very painful, and they can be treated as well. But yeah, I believe so. It's the same for animals. So pet owners are much more likely to develop tick-borne disease than not pet owners, by the way.
What are some other signs that might get overlooked or mistaken for something else?
Well, you could, there is a summer flu, of course, but that's really, we always think Lyme disease first, of course, when you have something like that. But you have patients that come in and could be other more serious infections. Some of them are mistreated as a tick-borne disease. It turns out to be something like meningitis or something else that's much more serious. So you got to be concerned about that. Certainly, if we're not sure what's wrong with the patient, we'll draw blood work. And anaplasmosis is one of those diseases where you're not really sure because there's no rash, but the same symptoms. But the blood counts are always lower and the platelet counts lower, and they're very sick. The good thing, the treatment is the same. It's the same doxycycline. But some of them may need to be required to be admitted because they're pretty sick.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about the mild symptoms that some people should look at and get checked out right away. When does that mild symptom become something else?
Well, yeah, I say when it persists. We have people come in a couple of days, they've been feverish, but they get better. That's probably not a tick-borne disease. But anyway, if it persists and you're going on a week and you're sick, and I had a runner who used to run 10, 12 miles a day. She came out for a run and she couldn't run more than a mile. She knew something was wrong. She ended up having anaplasmosis, and had all the right symptoms, right? So I think that lasts more than you think it should. Come to the emergency room. We'll take some blood tests, You'd be surprised, too. People come in. You don't look at their back. We look at their back. We see this huge rash that's been brewing for like a week that they don't see, because they don't know why they're sick. And that's an easy tip off for us. That's Lyme disease. And especially children. Children get Lyme disease a lot. We see a lot of young kids under 5. I think it's one of the top age groups to develop Lyme disease is children under 7 or 8, I believe, and older Americans as well, of course.
Wow. And do you recommend the next step if you think you might have one of these conditions or symptoms to go to ER or urgent care? Is that the right next thing to do?
Oh, definitely. Yes, absolutely. Because, you're not going to get better by yourself. You're going to need some antibiotics. And by the time they present to the emergency room, a lot of times they're pretty sick. And, the good thing about Lyme disease is it's very treatable. Early stage, very treatable. Antibiotics for 10 to 14 days. Doxycycline, make sure you stay out of the sun with that medication. The longer they wait, boy, the harder it is to treat. Lyme disease can develop into the joint swelling. Lyme arthritis can develop into your heart, Lyme carditis. You don't want to get to that stage. You want to catch it early, get the antibiotics, and enjoy the rest of the summer. And very rarely do people develop chronic Lyme disease, and it's usually because people are mistreated or misdiagnosed on their first visit, and they're put on the wrong antibiotic, or they're treated with something other type of infection diagnosis that they didn't have in the first place.
Let's talk about protecting yourself indoors and out when you're outside hiking or gardening or just spending time outside. What are some tips to stay safe?
Yeah, there's a couple things you can do. They always talk about tucking your socks into your long pants. But who wears long pants when they're hiking? Not very many people, right? The best thing really to do is you can spray yourself with there's a newer you can use permethrin on your clothes. And there's a company called, you know, can I say a company's name? InsectShield.com. They actually, if you send them their clothes, they'll spray them for you. And they'll send them back to you in about 2 weeks, cost about $100. And it lasts over 70 washings, and it kills ticks. It's a insecticide. So that's very safe. You can buy permethrin from the same company, and you can spray on your shoes and socks. And when you're hiking, look down your feet all the time, because you'll be surprised. You'll see ticks crawling up. That's how they get. They crawl up your legs, right? They don't jump. They don't hop, you know. They go on. They find you by on the ground or by a shrub, and they kind of latch onto you. So if you just keep a constant look at yourself and make sure you're not getting ticks crawled on you, that will help too. When you come home, make sure you check yourself thoroughly. Get naked and check yourself thoroughly, because ticks like to find those places behind your knee, especially in tufts of hair. You know, thick hair behind your ears, another big spot for children, in your belly button, in your armpit, your bra line, you know, all those places where ticks like to go. So the main thing is treat yourself. You can also spray yourself with some oil-based sprays, like eucalyptus oil is a commonly one used. You can find a lot of stuff online as well. Permethrin for your clothes, never your skin. You can use picaridin, which is available now. On Avon has a product called Bugs. I think it's called Bug Guard Plus. Mm-hmm. It's a really very safe insect repellent. So as well as D for those who like to use D as well.
Yeah, you're mentioning a few brand names. There are a lot of different repellents out there, so folks want to Google
that. Yeah.
If you mentioned young children again, I just want to emphasize again precautions families should take with young children, specifically because you mentioned that they are at higher risk. You mentioned checking hair and those other areas. Any other precautions families with young children should take?
I think just treating them with permethrin is safe. I don't think you want to use the kids under five, but you can use those sprays. I think that's important. Citronella is another one you can use. But the main thing is parents are really good, because they've gotten pretty good at checking for ticks when they come home, even outside the front lawn. When they come back in and play all day long, you got to get them undressed and check their body parts, right? Check their behind the knee, their hairline, especially girls have a lot of thick hair, right? So very commonly see ticks, and ticks that don't get removed, you know, they secrete a cement, and that cement allows the tick to stay on for days and days and days. And you might never find it in a let's say a young girl with like thick hair, and all of a sudden she gets sick and nobody knows why. And then we do an examination in the ER and we find an engorged tick, you know, feeding on their hairline or the back of their ear, which is a very common spot. Very common spot behind the ear. So make sure you check those places. You know, we have schools that do lice checks, and they find more ticks
than lice.
Then they bring the kids into the emergency room because they got an embedded tick in behind their ear or in their scalp, which is always good to find. You want to remove these ticks within 24 hours. You know, they can infect you pretty quickly, unlike mosquitoes. I mean, mosquitoes can infect you very quickly in one bite, but it takes ticks 12, 16, 18, 24 hours to really infect you. So that's a good thing. If you remove them pretty quickly, your chance of getting Lyme disease is very, very low. That's really the key, is get them, don't let them stay on if you can in the first place, but get them off you as soon as you can.
You're right there in the front line in the emergency room at Ellenville Regional. Is there one thing you wish more people understood about the health risks at this time of the year in the region?
Yeah, I just say, you know, you got to be careful. You know, when you're outside, I know it's carefree, it's summertime, and, you know, the clothing you wear really does make a difference. Light-colored clothing, you'll see those black ticks very easily, right? And mosquitoes like dark-colored clothing, so that's so light-colored clothes is preferred to summertime. You can see them. You know, when I used to work at the health department, we would do tick questing. We would take a cloth sheet, and run around the grass. We would see ticks like crazy. That's how many there are. You don't even know they're there. Mm. You know, they're made not to be seen and felt, right? So I think just the main thing is really check them when they come back inside, spray their clothes if they have to, spray their skin with picaridin, any kind of online spray is fine, but just follow those directions, of course.
Okay.
And that's really the best thing, really, is just to check them when they come inside for sure.
That's Dave Williams from Ellenville Regional Hospital. He's there in the ER, and we've been talking about ticks, mosquitoes, and other illnesses and warmer weather critters. There's more information at Ellenville Regional Hospital's website, erhny.org. Dave, thanks so much for joining us today. Thanks so much for what you do there for folks in the ER.
Hey, thanks for what you're doing. Congratulations. I know you have your third-year anniversary at your new location, Liberty, at the end of June, so mid-June. Right? So congratulations on that.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. Take care. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the events in Albany last week and what's coming up as lawmakers close out the legislative session. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
AI companies are running out of high-quality data to train their models, but they say they might have a solution.
I do think in the future, it seems quite possible that more of training for these big models is actually inference generating synthetic data to then go feed into the model.
What happens when you train your AI on AI-generated data? That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
Forgetting something, whether it's a colleague's name or where we put our keys, can make us feel like our memory is faulty. But is that really true?
Forgetting is not just a side effect of memory. It's not memory failing. It's part of what memory is supposed to do.
Why our minds were built to forget. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York lawmakers are looking to their final weeks at the state capitol. Reporters Jimmy Vielkind and John Campbell of the New York Public News Network break down the events of last week and what's ahead in Albany.
Hey, John, it's Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy.
So, John, the budget is finally behind us, and I thought of this as kind of a reset week at the state capitol. What are the big items coming up in the final weeks of the legislative session in Albany?
Yeah, we've got just about a month left in the legislative session, and this week there was another big rally for the New York for All Act. It would restrict how local law enforcement officials interact with federal immigration authorities. I mean, it would essentially make a sanctuary state policy. You know, we're also seeing more activity on what's known as the Medical Aid in Dying Bill, or at least I should say supporters say that. Opponents call it physician-assisted suicide, and this is the bill that would allow terminally ill people to request medication to end their life. The big question there is whether the Senate takes it up. The Assembly has already passed it. Here's what Senate Majority Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins had to say about that.
They said it's a conversation that I am willing to have with my members. I have said to the advocates that in order to pass anything, I need 32 votes, and I think we've got about 25 now that are on the bill.
So we'll see how that goes. Jimmy, another thing that happened this week at the Capitol was a hearing about prison policy. This comes after that 3-week wildcat strike by corrections officers and after murder charges were filed in 2 separate beating deaths in prisons near Utica. You were listening to that hearing. What were the highlights?
Well, the point of the hearing was to generate momentum for bills that advocates like Senator Julia Salazar say will bring greater oversight to the prison system. And we heard some testimony from people whose loved ones have been incarcerated, including from Robert Ricks, who is the father of Robert Brooks, one of those 2 men who was beaten to death. We also heard from Corrections Commissioner Dan Marticello. He talked about several measures that were just passed in the state budget that demand a little bit more oversight, including one that requires the use of body-worn cameras whenever a corrections officer is interacting with an incarcerated person. So Marticello said they would be deployed in all prisons by the end of the summer. One of the big moments that stood out to me, though, came from a panel of 3 union leaders. One of them, Wayne Spence, used to work as a parole officer, and he talked about how hard these prison jobs are and what the conditions are inside these facilities. Take a listen to what he had to say.
Nobody's interested in coming in there. So it's tough to recruit and retain. And when you add a staff shortage to it, and the draconian, toxic work environment, it's hell.
Jimmy, that doesn't sound promising for the state's hope to recruit more corrections officers, which it desperately needs.
No, not at all, John. Not at all.
So, Jimmy, what's on the horizon?
Well, I spoke this week with Republican Congressmember Mike Lawler, who's one of the holdouts on a big Republican fiscal bill in Washington. Lawler wants to see a bigger increase in the deduction for state and local taxes, which is a big deal in high-cost suburbs of New York City like the one that Lawler represents. But it puts him at odds with other Republicans from around the country who want to see spending reduced and who see that SALT deduction as kind of a giveaway to relatively wealthy people in blue states. So as that bill's being negotiated, which Republican leaders hope it will get a vote in Washington before Memorial Day.
Well, we'll certainly be watching, because a big part of that bill could be big cuts to spending that New York State budget relies on to the tune of tens of billions of dollars. If those cuts are big, the state legislature might have to come back and remake the state budget.
Yep. We'll be watching indeed. Until next time, John.
Bye, Jimmy.
Jimmy Vilkind and John Campbell from the New York Public News Network. We'll take a break, and when we come back, the Himalayan Institute. Whether you're a seasoned seeker or simply curious about reconnecting with yourself in a deeper way, we'll learn more about the Institute, and its director, Brian Fulp, is here next after this. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan 180. Building healthy communities through people, places, and policy one degree at a time. More information at Sullivan180.org. From The River Reporter, the community newspaper covering four counties in Pennsylvania and New York along the Upper Delaware River. RiverReporter.com. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, I'm Tim Bruno, General Manager at Radio Catskill. Hudson Valley Gives is Wednesday, and we need you. Your donation helps keep trusted news, diverse voices, and local culture on the air for everyone. Now more than ever, your support makes a difference. Give where you live. Go to hvgives.org and donate to Radio Catskill. We are navigating uncertainty with the strength of our community behind us. Donate at hvgives.org. Thanks.
Radio Catskill. Keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6. Right after All Things Considered. The local edition. Only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As part of our partnership with the Chamber of the Northern Poconos, we've got Chamber Chats today. And today we're taking you into the heart of one of the most respected centers for yoga, wellness, and spiritual growth in the country, the Himalayan Institute, nestled right here in the hills of Honesdale, Pennsylvania. Joining us is Brian Fulp, the Institute's Retreat Center Director and a lifelong member of its vibrant community, from his beginnings as a teenage volunteer to becoming a central figure in shaping the Institute's culture and guest experience. He's also a dedicated community leader with deep ties to local initiatives like the Roots and Rhythm Music and Arts Festival and the Rotary Club. Brian Fulp, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Tim. Somebody's been doing their homework.
We do a little research. We do a little digging here. I want to ask you about your involvement here. Starting as a teenager, we were just talking about this before we came on air. You joined when you were 14?
That's right. Yeah, 14 in Indiana, and made my way out here. You know, my debut was what? 1983, I came out for a program at the Institute in Honesdale.
What drew you to the center, and how do you think your role has evolved over the years? Well, I guess from a teenager to the director, there's an evolution
There was an evolution. You know, in 97, I came out to the Institute to help them build their first website. That's back when they were wondering whether the internet would go anywhere or not.
Right. What is this thing?
Yeah, so we created the first website, and from there, you know, I got old. And evolved into the retreat center director. That's a longer story.
Let's talk about the Himalayan Institute. You know, just basically your mission and what you do there for folks who may not be familiar with the Himalayan Institute.
Yeah, it's amazing. There's 110 people who live there year round. There's families, there's younger folks and older generations like myself. And we're all working towards a common goal. And that's the mission, which is to inspire, educate, and empower those who wish to reach their full potential.
And how do you guys go about that? I mentioned a few of the areas within which you do that. Talk a little bit about those.
That's right. The thing I'm most excited about, I think, are the mission programs. Those are classes and programs that we teach. They're based on teachings from a 5,000-year-long tradition. And so we're able to keep those alive. And I think the challenge is just changing with the times. Something we taught 20 years ago is going to be taught in a very different way, probably in 15-minute chunks now.
Talk about this ancient wisdom and the philosophy behind that and how it applies and how you try to apply it to modern life.
I think everybody listening today feels a sense of stress, pressure, something in their life that they'd like to make changes. And surprisingly, 5,000 years ago, they were doing the same thing. And I think that these teachings are as much alive today. Breathing, diet, nutrition, relaxation, those are all as important today as they were back then.
I think that some folks might think of something religious when they think of this. That's not the case here. You're talking about the basic principles of ancient wisdom like breathing and meditation.
That's exactly right. What we teach is more scientific. It's a question I get every single day. We are a spiritual organization, and I'll tell you right now, there might be two Hindus on the campus, and there are probably 103, you know, Catholic, Episcopalian Christians working towards the same mission.
And how does someone get involved? You know, do you need to be someone who lives there? Do you need to be part of the community on site? Or do you open it up across the community, across the world, really?
Well, it is around the world. And I think service is like the cornerstone of what we practice. That's one of the big ones. And whether it's local or abroad, you know, that's what drives us and we're passionate about. I would like to point out that our volunteer program that just launched maybe 12 months ago here in Honesdale has grown now to 75 really passionate volunteers who are empty nesters or they want to take a break from their normal work and come out and help. And we shoot an email out that says, hey, we have a house that needs to be painted or we have leaves to rake or trails to clear. We always have a list of people who come, and there are perks to that, too.
Yeah, and you have something called a getaway week, volunteer getaway week, too?
Yeah, we launched these trail crew getaway. It turned out, since COVID, we learned that people just want to get out of the city. They want to get out of their offices. They just want to be in nature. So we have a lot of fun, but we also have educational portions of that, and they get to do something great for the Institute, too.
I want to talk a little bit more again about modern life, and you mentioned the website and digital.
Yeah.
That's a big part of what you do in addition to the in-person retreats, these online offerings. How do you envision seeing this balance between the in-person part of it and the online part of it?
You know, that was a struggle even 5-6 years ago. I have to go back to COVID again. It drove us online, and what we learned was we found that people were looking for connection. They wanted community, and they were able to find that online. And the sort of the balance that we found was connecting them with a capstone type event. Let's say you have 5 programs online and it ends at the Institute. You would not believe the attendance and the people trying to, you know, make their way to Honesdale.
One of your missions is yoga in action. Your humanitarian mission is yoga. Talk about that and how that helps. How does that help heal and transform not just the individual, but this humanitarian effort worldwide? It's an amazing effort. It's also somehow maybe difficult for some to comprehend.
Well, I've learned through even Rotary International, the Chamber of Commerce, no matter where you are, there's a need, right? So there's tons of things that people need. And I think an individual can just do what they do. What I'm really excited about, especially abroad, is at our community centers, we have 2 of them, at the basic level, you know, water is a need, food security is a need. So we have programs at those campuses in India where you can actually see and meet the folks who are benefiting from that. And I've got stories way beyond that for anybody who'd like to reach out.
I was going to ask you a story or two. Is there a particular memorable experience or interaction that you have in your many years there that stands out to you and also helps and reaffirm your commitment to the Himalayan Institute's mission?
I actually have those experiences every day just working with the Chamber of Commerce, Chamber of Northern Poconos. I'm really passionate about working in Honesdale. But there's one instance in our community center in India, and it's where we created a massive well, and we were ready to provide water to all the communities in the area. And it was an area that had no water. The thing that stuck out to me was that the minute we started delivering water in these huge, I don't know, I call them, you know, camelback containers, then suddenly the other communities came forward and said, why aren't we getting the water? Well, there was only so much water you could give and there was only so much time. But the fighting that came from that, and we were able to settle that. We were able to step in and say, hey, let's have an application process. Everybody's going to get water. But I think our ability to bring such a great resource to the community and then solving a problem that we almost created by bringing this resource to the community, I thought that was a big service, a thing of service for us too.
I'm going to ask you about us more locally in Honesdale, youth engagement. How do you work with young people and that approach to community service?
I really appreciate the way Wayne Highlands has opened up their school. We have a program through Rotary called Interact, and it's where high school students are able to take on service projects, practice their own leadership skills. And we started that, Rotary from Honesdale started that in that school maybe 15 years ago. And every single year, they're able to raise money. You're able to work with kids who are passionate and intelligent. And these kids are networked, Tim. It's really amazing to watch them in action. So that's how we are able to support. And the Institute is all in with any resource that we have.
For someone who's considering their first visit to the Himalayan Institute, the Retreat Center, what advice or encouragement would you offer them to take that step and talk about some of the things that are coming up?
We just had a couple hundred people at our community open house. And I think the theme through that whole open house was that you don't have to come prepared with anything. You can come as you are. You don't need special clothes. You don't need, yoga pants. You don't need whatever. You need. Just come as you are and start there. We have classes that are open to everybody. So you can look on our calendar and find out morning, evening classes. We've got a cafe. You may have heard of Mocha Origins. There's chocolate bean to bar factory outlet on our campus. Come there and have a cup of coffee, walk the campus, and just start wherever you are. If you want advanced programs, we've got that. But if you want to come and just do a general yoga class or anything like that, we're there for you.
As someone who's deeply embedded into the Institute's daily life, how do you maintain balance and clarity?
That's a constant challenge, even when you live there. People say, I wish I lived at the Institute and I could, you know, have access to all this relaxation and peace. We are like anywhere else, and it is a constant struggle, but we support each other. There's 110 people who are literally supporting each other through their daily practice of, you know, exercise, just finding balance in their work, and also supporting each other. It's something that I think is so important, even in our daily lives.
Well, you may have personal daily struggles, but you seem like the most relaxed guy I've ever encountered.
So. Oh, my, that's great, Tim. Thanks. It's
Something's
working.
Something's working.
It's working.
Looking ahead, what kind of legacy do you hope to leave at the Institute? And how do you see your role evolving, coming from, you know, starting as a teenager to where you are now?
I've always been impressed by, like, Rodale Press and Rodale Farms and I can totally see where the Institute, now that we're over 50 years old, where we will be a major foundation, a foundational place in this community, and how we'll grow into a career. You know, I'm not totally sure. We are all volunteers working towards a common goal, and I would love to keep that passion alive as we turn this into a career that a family, you know, people can just continue to support their families in the community.
Where can folks get more information?
HimalayanInstitute.org.
All right.
And reach out to me personally anytime. I'll take any phone call anytime, any day.
Brian Fulp is the Himalayan Institute's Retreat Center Director and lifelong member of the Institute. Thank you so much for joining us and for being here. We were talking again. We've been trying to connect for, like, I don't know, 5 years.
At least,
finally.
<yeah.
laughs> Thanks for coming over.
Thanks so much, Tim.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll get to the latest episode of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast. Tom Candela is next. This is Radio Catskill.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
I'm
Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, being a documentary filmmaker used to mean taking a vow of poverty. Then came streaming.
I'm told between 30 and 40 million people saw that movie.
We talked with the filmmaker R.J. Cutler, who's behind some of the biggest documentary films in recent years. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Tom Candela is host of our new Radio Catskill podcast, Curtain Call, focusing on local theater. And he joins us now for a preview of the latest episode, which just dropped on Friday. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Tim. How are you?
Good. Who are you talking to on this episode?
So on this episode of Curtain Call, we're exploring the rich intersection where theater meets the land, quite literally. I'm joined by Tanis Kowalczyk and Jess Beveridge of Farm Arts Collective. They're an innovative performance group based out of the Willow Wisp Organic Farm. Yep, in Damascus, Pennsylvania. These two remarkable young ladies refer to themselves as performers. You see what they've done there,
I see what they did. It's kind of like that chat skill thing we're doing
It's like a chat skill
thing.
We love
a good
pun
over
good.
Here.
So we're talking about their unique devised theater process and their upcoming immersive production of Lucy Joseph and, of course, their much-loved Dream on the Farm series. That's all coming up within the next couple of months. And I think Lucy Joseph is actually in June, so that's real soon.
Real soon.
A couple of weeks from now.
Yep. All right, here's an excerpt of the latest episode of Curtain Call. Tom with Farm Arts Collective.
Great. Today I'm thrilled to welcome two remarkable artists from the innovative Farm Arts Collective. First, there is Tanis Kowalczyk, the artistic director and a true pioneer in devised theater and creative placemaking. Tanis is also an organic farmer, co-owning Willow Wisp Organic Farm right in our area in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Joining her also in the studio today is Jess Beveridge, the dynamic company manager of Farm Arts Collective. Jess also manages greenhouses and flowers at the Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm, and she brings her rich theatrical experiences from AMDA and numerous New York companies to her work both on the stage and in the fields. Give us a little idea, Tanis, how you developed this production company and how you integrate the agricultural aspects of the Will-O-Wisp Farm into your productions.
Sure. I think Farm Arts Collective came about because of Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm. You know, I was running a production company, an ensemble, a group called North American Cultural Laboratory, or NACL. We had started in New York City and moved up to Sullivan County in 2000 and started running experimental theater festivals. It was really exciting. And I realized that I loved working with artists and scientists and visual artists, a lot of different kinds of people in my community to create a project. And that sort of planted the seed. I just was like, I think it's time to bring this kind of this interest in community engagement to the farm to talk about the issues of climate change and sustainability and social and eco-justice. And it was just like this melding of all the different things that I was doing into one place and time, and bringing the community engagement practice in the theater performances I was making with community to the farm. It just all kind of made sense to me. And so I named it Farm Arts Collective. It was just like kind of an efficiency move as well as a move of mission.
Why don't you just talk a little bit about the mission of the Farm Arts Collective?
Yeah, absolutely. Sure. Farm Arts Collective, we're based on four main pillars of life-sustaining practices in farming, art, food, and ecology. So we are not just a theater company or workshop producers or farmers, but we try to bring in all of those four pillars into everything that we're doing. We have workshops on farming, sustainability, fermenting, flowers. We also have performances surrounding social justice. We have an annual Juneteenth event. We have a science cabaret that's been really successful. We have a solo festival that we invite solo artists to come and share their work on in our theater. And then we also serve farm fresh food at almost every single one of our events. So we try to tie in all of those things into everything that we're doing.
I wanted to find opportunities for our community and the public to literally come in and experience what we're doing here and like the joys of farming. I really wanted to present farming in the context of Farm Arts Collective in an artistic way. So the response has been people really liking the theater experience because it's usually very fun and very innovative. Like I said, you know, all these people making a play together. It's very surprising, like what we come up with. The stories are unique and curious. I mean, the shows sell out.
The shows sell out every year. And we're finding that, I say this often, but we're finding that people that would come to a theater performance and not necessarily come to a farm are still coming and vice versa. It's just a really great cross-pollination. And we're finding that it is opening and broadening our audience and our community.
Let's talk a little bit about the creative placemaking that. Tell us how that fits into the workshops and the performances that you produce over at the farm.
Okay. The best example of the creative placemaking that is Dream on the Farm and Farm Arts Collective is that we are creating work with the people who live in this community in Pennsylvania, in New York. We are enlivening a local agricultural space that is now multi-use, where people can see where their food comes from. Where they're getting their food is also a place they can come and learn about something. They can see a cool show. They can propose a show mm-hmm. to us. They can say, can I do my jazz? Mm-hmm. Can I bring my show about autism? It's their space mm-hmm. too. So it's a collective and mm-hmm. we are enlivening and we are celebrating this place, this land, this community's history of farming, this community's history of activism and music and river life. And everything we're doing is about that. So it's connecting to place. We are stewarding our land, being organic farmers, and we're also stewarding our community and treating it with respect and nurturing it and cultivating it so that it can keep growing. And that's what I think of when I think of creative placemaking, and that's what I want to do.
You know, it's a really great open door policy at Farm Arts Collective. We have open workshops from January, February, March, but it's really throughout the entire year. If someone approaches Tanis and says, hey, I want to, you know, be a part of this, or I want to bring something, we always try to find a way to make that happen for these people, to make them heard and to have a place in our community.
That's great. So let's go now into a little bit more about the shows themselves. You're doing Jazz a Show.
Lucy Joseph.
Yes. Tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So Lucy Joseph, it goes up. We open June 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th. That's four performances at Farm Arts Collective at 7 o'clock those evenings. And Lucy Joseph is a real person, a historical figure that lived in the 1800s. Yes. And actually strolled the very streets of Honesdale right outside of the studio. A fascinating person. Mimi McGurl, who is the director and also the writer of this piece, wrote this original piece with help from Bill Klaber's book, The Rebellion of Miss Lucy Ann Lovedell. And we tell the story of her life. And
well, let's hear a little bit about that, because she was a very unique person in her time,
yes.
right? Way ahead of her time.
Way ahead of her time, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So Lucy Joseph was born Lucy Ann. And she discovered that when she got a little bit older, that she needed to find work. And work back then for women were either school teachers or homemakers. So she decided to, the way to get work was to disguise herself as a man. And that's what she did. She disguised herself as a man and she went out and got these jobs. And she was also penned as the female huntress of Long Eddy. She had a great shot. She was really skilled in all of those homesteading, and she ended up falling in love with a woman, which was one of the first times that that was ever documented, something that wasn't talked about.
Right.
And she was essentially put away in an insane asylum for dressing as a man and for refusing to put on a dress and refusing not to dress as a woman. And she lived her life out in an insane asylum for 30 years.
Give us the dates again. Yes. We want you to get in there and get some tickets for this.
Yes, it's Thursday through Sunday, June 5th through 8th at 7 o'clock at Farm Arts Collective. And you can get tickets on our website, farmartscollective.org or myrivertickets.com, which is our ticketing platform.
Also in June, of course, we have the Juneteenth celebration. Let's talk a little bit about that, how you've integrated this important event in our nation's history onto your farm and into your production company.
Absolutely. Well, I have been collaborating with Janice Adams for a while now. And, you know, Janice is on WJFF. She has the Janice Adams Show, and she's an African-American historian and a journalist. And then we have Oliver King, who will be doing a piece about Langston Hughes. And then we have our friend Gray Wolf, who's a Lenape member of the Nation in New Jersey. He's going to be giving a land acknowledgement and talking about the history of the land and doing an opening prayer. And so it'll be a really great night, and we'll have some food, as we always do.
From the Will West Farm.
Yes,
of course. Yep.
Of course.
Farm fresh.
Farm fresh food at almost every event, actually. Yep. We always make some kind of offering, you know, just for people to stay and talk.
That's great. Yeah. Give us the date of that.
Juneteenth. That's June 19th. Yeah.
June 19th.
At 7 Thursday. O'clock.
7 p.m. Mm-hmm. on the farm.
Yes.
Anything you would like to add about your season, about upcoming things that are happening on your farm?
So on May 24th, we have a visiting company from New Orleans. It's a company called Art Spot Productions, and Kathy Randalls is the lead artist in this performance. And she's created a play that brings together her upbringing with two Baptist ministers as parents and her 25 years working at the Louisiana Correctional Facility. Yeah. And she's part of this performance because it's about the prison system. And her name is Mama Glow Williams. So Mama Glow is going to be at our theater as part of this presentation about incarceration and forgiveness. And I mean, it's going to be a fascinating evening.
Okay.
24th at 7 o'clock.
And we're going to go to what website for that?
FarmArtsCollective.org.
Beautiful. There's also a lot of other things happening on your farm. Mm-hmm. We have Family Farm Day, farm tour with lunch. We have flower cut and design. This is all coming up in the next several months. All these fun things that are happening right here in our neighborhood, folks, at the Willow Wisp Farm. I want to thank Tanis Kowalczyk and Jess Beveridge for sharing their insight, their passion, and truly inspiring work over at the Farm Arts Collective. Thank you, ladies, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Tom Candela of Curtain Call, our new local theater podcast. And that was just a clip. You can hear the full episode on our website.
Full episode at WJFFradio.org. You just click on the little community or the tab that says shows. And then you go down to podcast and you'll find Curtain Call with Tom Candela. Or if you have a smart device, go like Alexa. You say, hey, Alexa, play Curtain Call with Tom Candela. You have to add the Tom Candela because there are other Curtain Call productions out there.
Who do you have coming up?
This week we have, we are featuring the Sullivan County Dramatic Workshop. That'll be this Friday. You'll hear a clip from that. That's with Harold Tai and Pete Nastasi, and had a really good conversation with those folks. And it's been the response to Curtain Call has been great so far, and I'm really, really pleased. A lot of people are coming over and sitting down and interviewing and having a lot of fun.
Well, and thanks for doing it. You're providing a forum for folks to be able to speak a lot longer than just a, you know, segment here, and give them a chance to really dive in and talk more about all the great theater and arts and culture in our community.
Very, very fortunate. We have a great community of theater and talented artists here in our community.
Tom Candela, thanks so much. We'll see you Friday.
All right. Thank you.
We'll take a quick break. And when we come back, wrap up of the Songs of Protest concerts, which was held yesterday. This is Radio Catskill.
Jason Dole here, letting you know that Radio Catskill's Music Yard Sale returns Saturday, May 24th, and we need musical donations. So if you do some spring cleaning and find vinyl records in good condition that you don't need anymore, or CDs, stereo equipment, instruments, cassettes, donate them to us. Get a little extra space for yourself and support a great cause. Email mimi@wjffradio.org and make your musical donation to the Music Yard Sale, May 24th at Radio Catskill in Liberty.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, yesterday at the Narrowsburg Union, it was the Sing It Loud Songs of Protest concert that was co-organized by our own Kathy Geary, along with Cynthia Nash and Jill Padua. Our own Rosie Starr was there and spoke to Brendan Whedon of the Narrowsburg Union about the event.
Yeah, we had a great concert here today. A lot of great artists singing their hearts out. A lot of big audience cheering them on. It was people kind of expressing, maybe I would say, in a very peaceful way, their dissatisfaction with the way some things are going in our lovely country. It was an expression of love for each other and love for our country and love for all the things that make us great, and something that I'm personally very passionate about, and that's our Constitution. There are attacks being made by some people on the Constitution, which is the foundation of our American way of life. It's the rule of law. It's how we behave and how we conduct ourselves. And I think it's important that we all reacquaint ourselves with the Constitution. There's a very short preamble, which is really the heart and soul of it. There are articles and there are amendments, and everybody should revisit them and just be familiar with what they are, because they are core to our beliefs. And no one has the right to change that unless we all agree to change it. No one has a right to trample it. We have to respect it. There are three branches of government. No branch is greater or better than the other branch. Everybody is accountable. We live with the rule of law, and everyone is subject to that law completely. So we printed up on a poster size the preamble and the listing of the articles and amendments, and we made it a poster. And kind of like you did in high school when you signed the yearbook for your buddies, we put out magic markers and asked everybody to come sign. It's their commitment that they believe that the Constitution is a very important document. And if you wanted to make a message, you could make a message. Some people wrote a little message next to certain amendments that they think are particularly at risk or particularly important. And it was great. It was a way for people to express themselves. So we're going to take this signed Constitution support document and make a poster of it. We're going to hang it here in the building. And if anybody who signed it wants a copy of it, we'll be happy to make them a copy so they can have it for themselves. So it was a great day. And come to our art show opening on June 28th.
Thank you for that, Brendan. But I'd like to know, you hosted this, you provided the venue here at the Union inside Delaware Hall, and you attended the event. What is your takeaway? How did you feel listening to these songs?
You know, I was really struck by a number of people who made a point that just because someone has beliefs different than us, they're not the enemy. And we really need to strive to find that middle ground that we all agree with and that we're going to work to make better. There are a number of quotes by some of the famous peacemakers of our time. Think of Henry David Thoreau. He's not our time, but he was a great resistance to things that he thought weren't right in government. And that's an inspiration. And Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King. These are people who lived in justice, and they pushed back, and they did it in a peaceful way. Indira Gandhi, I'm sorry, the other one. That's what we need to do at these times. We need to push back in a peaceful way, and we need to get everybody on the same page. So I think I was enthused to hear almost all of the singers talked about, let's find peace. It's not that we're protesting and we're at war. It's like we're protesting. Let's find that middle ground. That was encouraging.
The Brizzy Star speaking to Brendan Whedon of the Narrowsburg Union about yesterday's Sing It Loud concert. Thank you for that, Rosie. And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Reminder, our music yard sale is coming up this Saturday, 10 to 3 here at our Liberty Studios. All kinds of musical equipment, CDs, records, instruments, you name it, all priced to move. It's here at our Liberty Studios this Saturday starting at 10 a.m. We hope to see you. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Chatskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Cooper R. Grace, KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskills Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
I'm Jesse King, On this week's 51%, we learn about an organization offering community to children impacted by incarceration and deportation.
Someone gets taken away, and it's children, and it's parents, and it's like this whole extended world of people who are impacted.
This week on 51%.
Monday night at 8 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill Local News, Culture, and NPR. Mainly sunny this afternoon, a high of 59, windy with gusts up to 25 miles an hour and some higher wind gusts possible. Overnight, mainly clear. For most of the area, it's a low around 40, but for some higher elevations in Delaware and Sullivan and northeast Pennsylvania, there's a frost advisory in effect until 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Cold temperatures as low as 32 expected, and frost could, of course, harm sensitive outdoor vegetation. Looking ahead to tomorrow, mix of clouds and sun early, then becoming cloudy later in the day and a high of 61. 52 right now in Liberty.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.